Tickets are on sale at The Bookshelf, 41 Quebec Street in downtown Guelph, a physically accessible location, and on ticketbreak.com.
Join us each week, Thursday evenings from 9 to 10 p.m. for Jazz Traditions. We'll highlight music from the 1940s through the 1970s, from Art Tatum to Zoot Sims. We'll occasionally have an interview or guest, too. That's Thursdays at 9 here on CFRU for Jazz Traditions.
Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its numerous cultural expressions. It runs March 3rd to 23rd in communities across Canada. La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures, in partnership with the National Campus and Community Radio Association, through the Community Radio Fund of Canada and this station, present the RBF series. To help celebrate Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, 24 campus and community radio stations from across Canada produced a weekly show highlighting Rendez-vous de la Francophonie events, the importance of bilingualism, Francophone history and culture in Canada. The programming runs on this station between January and March 2016. For more information, check out www.ncra.ca/RVF.
CFRU Radio is pleased to feature RVF on Tuesdays from noon to 1 p.m.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Let me give you a little faith footnote. Turn your neighbor and say faith footnote.
Once again, it's the welfare. Consistently on our jobs. Shouts to the affiliates, man. Puerto Rican production, how we doing?
Continue to spark this. Our back door sounded like Marcus. So far to the left where Fark is. Left we feel we got enough mileage out of marches. And we give a perspective on community that reaches far deeper than these monsters. So of course I don't give a fuck about their bullshit, subpoenas, fabricated charges. Any signs of justice in this country are simply mirages. The freedom in America are not synonymous. The fact they're polar opposites. So I don't want to hear a word about that Obama shit. Death penalty, he won't abolish it. Ask him about his really defiance of Geneva Convention, he won't acknowledge it. Talk to him about Mexico right to the original land, he'll look at you in astonishment. But if you bring Afghanistan, he'll try to convince you to abominate. Don't tell me he's down with the people because of that ganja shit. Because imperialism put a black face at the head of American imperialism, part of it. And any illusions of our people's freedom, he now conjures it. Even some of our deepest MCs have been to seize on the fist. Some electoral rally go yonder with. Cause these pacifying functions we just don't bother with. It's egregious, he's so facetious, deceiving. Regarding change, we can believe it. If he turns a deaf ear on real people grieving. Obama support comes from the right wing of the Democrats, or where he's at. A warmonger with the same hunger to preemptively attack. White mask, but with his skin that's black. In fact, Barack hopes to team this borderless war. Find a kind of hope for the map.
Shouts to everybody. Yo, East Harlem to West Oakland, baby. The Bottoms. Shouts to the PLC, CJRIC, Chairman, Spell Stuster. Allow me to sit for a second and commence the rip. Then the shred fragments and bits are the bullshit they tryna get. We got munitions with banana clips, AK-47s with the wooden grips. Derringers with ornate tips to bring retribution for slave ships. The jungle and our hunger brings guerrilla warfare. We are Vietnamese in the tunnel, got you in our crosshairs and warfare. Squeeze off and displace air, blow your head clean clear. Bump your shoulders, we are soldiers and dangerous beasts like coaches, we don't care. So yeah, I'll cast the first stone, rock and pebble too. Fuck it, homie, I'll be shot putting boulders at your vestibule. You got your own, not I, neither diplomat nor scholar or Obama. Just a wild motherfucker who wants to blow me. Neck palm with sweat to show you how wild the poor people get. When a horn with his left to struggle and stress. Deep in his heart, a lion's death like a lion. I've slept. I'm so deadly. Check my plan, Ray. I'm so ready to come on semi. Look at my hand, God is so steady.
this country. My terror, away from the Sioux, the Apache, the Arawak, the Comanche, the Arapaho, the Navajo. Terrorism. We took Africans from their country to build our way of ease and kept them enslaved and living in fear. Terrorism. We bombed Grenada and killed innocent civilians, babies, non-military personnel. We bombed the black civilian community of Panama with stealth bombers and killed unarmed teenagers and toddlers, pregnant mothers and hard-working fathers. We bombed Gaddafi's home and killed his child. Blessed are they who bash your children's head against a rock. We bombed Iraq. We killed unarmed civilians trying to make a living. We bombed a plant in Sudan to pay back for the attack on our embassy. Killed hundreds of hard-working people, mothers and fathers who left home to go that day not knowing that they never get back home. We bombed Hiroshima. We bombed Nagasaki. And we knew far more than the thousands in New York and the Pentagon. And we never batted an eye. Kids playing in the playground, mothers picking up children after school, civilians, not soldiers. People just trying to make it day by day. We have supported state terrorism against the Palestinians and black South Africans, and now we are indignant because the stuff we have done overseas is now brought right back into our own front yard. America's chickens coming home. Begets violence. Hatred begets hatred. And terrorism begets terrorism. A white ambassador said that, y'all, not a black militant. Turn back to your neighbor and say, footnote is over. Now. Come on back.
Because if you know the history of the whole concept of whiteness, if you know the history of the whole concept of the white race, where it came from and for what reason, you know that it was a trick and it's worked brilliantly. See, prior to the mid to late 1600s in the colonies of what would become the United States, there was no such thing as the white race. Those of us of European descent did not refer to ourselves by that term really ever before then. In fact, in the old countries of Europe, we had spent most of our time killing each other. We didn't love each other. We weren't one big happy family. The side of my family that comes from Scotland, hell, they didn't even worry about fighting people outside of Scotland. Highlanders and Lowlanders just fought the hell out of each other. So there was no white race, but in the colonies of what would become the United States, what did we see in the 1660s, 1670s? We began to see that Africans of indentured servant status, many of them not enslaved yet, they were not necessarily permanently enslaved. Some were, others were indentured like many poor Europeans for periods of 7 to 11 years. They could work off their indenture and then they would be free labor technically. Realized, as did the white indentured servants, the Europeans who hadn't even been called white yet, that they had a lot of things in common, like the fact that they were all getting their clock cleaned by the elite. And so they would get together more than our history books taught us, to foment rebellion against the elite, to try to get a better deal for themselves on the basis of economic necessity and economic justice. And what did the elite do? When you see that you're outnumbered by black and white folks who are penniless, landless, peasants, you have to do one of two things. You either have to kill them all, but you can't do that because who's going to work? Rich folks weren't going to. They had to get poor people to work. The whole point was to be a person of leisure back in those days. That was the goal, was not to work. So you couldn't kill them all. You didn't want to kill them all. You had to do the work yourself. You had to build your own levee, build your own house. No, pick your own tobacco, harvest your own cotton. No, we're not going to do any of that. So you can't kill them, but you can co-opt them. And so the elite in Virginia, for example, in the colony, begins to give certain carrots to people of European descent, saying things like, you know, we're going to let you own a little land, not much, but just a little. And we're going to get rid of indentured servitude. Now you're free labor. And by the way, once you're free labor, you get 50 acres of land just because you're free labor, see? So we're going to cut you in on this deal. We're going to let you enter into contracts. We're going to let you testify in court. And here's the best of all. We're going to put you on the slave patrol to keep those people in line, right? The idea was you're still going to get your clock clean. We still don't like you. We still aren't going to really empower you or change your economic subordination, but we're going to make you honorary members of this team, and you're going to help us keep those other people down. And so they got a little taste of power, and it did effectively divide and conquer those coalitions. Those rebellions began to stop almost instantly. Fast forward to the Civil War era, you have rich white folks in the South, where I come from, standing up and openly admitting that the reason they're prepared to secede from the Union, and the only reason they ever articulated publicly, ever, was to maintain and extend slavery and white supremacy not only where it already existed, but into the newly acquired, that is to say, stolen territories from Mexico to the West. That was what they said. Now we lie about it. We say it wasn't about slavery, that it was about states' rights. Yes, the right of the states to keep and maintain slaves, exactly. But back then they had no shame, so they didn't try and cover it up. They openly said it, but once again, the rich didn't want to go do the work. Are you kidding? No. They're going to get poor people to go fight for them. And the poor folks didn't even own slaves. Now think, how do you get poor people who don't even own the shirt on their back, let alone slaves, to go fight to keep your slaves for you? You've got to convince them that their skin is more important than their economic interest. Because think about it, if I am a farmer who has to charge you $1 a day or $2 a week to work on your farm and harvest that tobacco or pick that cotton, but you can get a black person to do it for free because you own them, who's going to get the job? Not me. In other words, slavery actually undermined the wages and the wage base, the economic floor of the typical white working class or low-income person. But they were told, if these people are freed, they're going to take your job. No, fool, they got your job. That's the point. And so at some level, again, working class white people being harmed by white privilege, relatively being advantaged, right? Being given a leg up, being given a membership to the club, but in absolute terms being kept economically subordinated by the very thing that gave them a sense of superiority. How's that for irony? Then in the present era, this hasn't stopped. This is not ancient history. Now we have people running around insisting that we should close the border with Mexico because if we don't, the wages of working class people will continue to fall. The implication being that the only reason workers are paid like crap in this country is because the border is open. But if you believe that, you would actually have to believe that if that border were closed, that all these owners of capital and industry would just say, oh, well, you figured us out. Here, it's a raise. Do we really believe that the only thing keeping bosses from paying people more is the presence of low-wage, medium, semi-skilled labor from south of this artificial border? Is that really what we believe? We know that if that border is closed, it isn't going to be closed to capital. It isn't going to be closed to goods. If you have a border that can be crossed by capital looking for the highest return on investment or goods looking for the highest price, but labor is chained to its country of origin, how is that going to work to the benefit of working people? By definition, it doesn't. By definition, it immiserates the working class. Divide and conquer. But the best example of all, perhaps, in the contemporary era, in the greater New Orleans area after Katrina. Here you have two communities that were the most hard hit. The Lower Ninth Ward, mostly black community, 94% African American, about 40% official poverty rate, heavy working class community. And right across the canal, St. Bernard Parish, Chalmette, 95% white, also working class, high levels of poverty, economically very similar. And at the end of the day, in those first few days of September 2005, more similar than they probably would have realized. Because when those levees broke, they all got their stuff jacked. They all got their stuff destroyed. But if you had asked white folks in Chalmette, and I've done it, who was the cause of the problems in the greater New Orleans area prior to that flooding, they would have pointed across that canal at those black folks, wouldn't have called them black folks, and would have said, there, that's the problem. 70% of the white folks in St. Bernard Parish voted for David Duke, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, former head of the largest Ku Klux Klan group in the United States when he ran for governor in 1991. 7 out of 10 gladly voted for him because he was blaming black folks for all of their problems, and they bought it. What's the irony? The irony is that while they were blaming black people for their problems, while they were blaming black people for the conditions of the greater New Orleans area in which they lived, nobody was paying attention, least of all they, to the fact that these white elite politicians, either in Baton Rouge or in Washington, whose job it was to secure those levees, to make sure that levee funds were spent in the proper way and that they were spent at all, those mostly white and mostly elite politicians did nothing. At the end of the day, it wasn't just the black folks in the lower Ninth Ward they didn't care about. They really couldn't have given a rat's ass about those poor and working class white folks either. And yet, when the people of Chalmette, people of St. Bernard Parish got back into session, first time they had a city council meeting, parish council meeting after the flooding, the lights aren't even on yet. The water isn't even hooked up. And the first order of business was to pass an ordinance saying that you couldn't rent property in St. Bernard Parish to anyone who wasn't a blood relative. Now, I'll leave it to your imagination as to why you'd want to pass a law. That law had never existed before. But now that it's been emptied out and you don't know who might come back, that's a damn good way to keep black people out, isn't it? Because if you're 95% white to begin with, if you pass an ordinance that says that, that's a great way. You can't say no blacks need apply. You can't say no blacks allowed. But that was an ingenious way to get around the law. Now, they got caught. There was a lawsuit threatened and they got rid of the ordinance. But my point in bringing it up is to say, once again, divide and conquer is working. These white folks in Chalmette need to march across that canal and join hands with the black folks who've been sitting there more than willing to work with them for an awful long time and march on Baton Rouge and march on DC and march on the Corps of Engineers and recognize their commonality of interest. But the whiteness and the lure of whiteness has tricked these have nothing in their bank account white people into believing that they got more in common with the rich white folks on St. Charles Avenue that didn't lose anything in that flooding than they have in common with the black working class folks who live about 500 yards away.
Well, now in its sixth day, the strike in what started across 10 Georgia prisons continues. It's now become the biggest prisoner strike in the history of the United States.
No, 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 no. Oh, yeah. I'm in chains, you're in chains too. Our uniforms and you are uniforms too. I'm a prisoner, you're a prisoner too, Mr. Jailer. Oh, I have fears, you have fears too. I'll die, but yourself will die too. Life is beautiful, don't you think so too, Mr. Jailer? I'm talking to you, Jailer.
KKK, they did me. I think it's an honor, right?
You suppress all my strategies. You oppress all every part of me. What you don't know, you're a victim too, Mr. Jailer. Oh, you don't care about my point of view. If I die, will work for you.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be driven or beaten as such.
So you treat me like a modern slave, Mr. Jailer. I'm talking to you, Jailer.
What has happened here but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed?
Well, we're gonna die here in Attica today or tomorrow, and we ask you to get together, get our people together, and unite.
The people in here are treated like dogs. Not only the black, the Puerto Rican, and the white. And we're gonna get what we demand, or we're gonna die trying. Yes.
In the marketplace, down troll stones. Even if you do, you just might one of your own.
All these dogs up there with all those rations are trying to kill us. So we ain't gonna quit. You know, we're not white, no, we're not gonna quit. Because we're one unit. We're tired of being beaten. We're tired of being oppressed. We're gonna get this if we all have to die. All of us.
just liberated, you know, that I didn't have to worry about the bars in front of me, even though I knew that I was in prison. Now, that's the reality. But that visible thing wasn't there no more. You know, the wall was there, but that bar wasn't really in the front of me, that visible bar. It was more invisible than that.
Anybody else?
Me. I want to be a lawyer.
What's your name?
Just help people that are in jail that are not supposed to be in there. I'm going to get them out so they could have their family together and not be separated like my cousin. I want them to be together.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried. That was Asa with Mr. Jailer. And before that, we had Tim Wise with talking about white privilege. And before then, we had the Welfare Poets with Let It Be Known. I want to first begin with a little bit of self-criticism on my part. The show last week kind of fell apart. I am partially to blame for that. Technical issues did the rest. But I basically fell apart. I actually had something of a nervous breakdown last week on the show. And part of that was because I put so much pressure on myself, you know, in lead up to that show. What I was going to do on that show is I was going to interview a comrade, a member of the Young Communist League in Ottawa, who had been a victim of police violence. So who is a person of color, he was a victim of racism, racist police abuse. I was going to interview her. And that did not work out. That did not work out, largely because of the pressure that I put on myself. Largely because of the pressure I put on myself. There were technical problems, you know, with the connection. And that did lead to some fumbling around and some problems. If you listened in last week, I mean, you'll notice, like, that there were definitely some issues. Things kind of kept cutting in and out. And it wasn't very coherent, what you were hearing. But basically, yeah, there were the technical issues. But at the same time, I had some various things which I had not addressed with my own self. And this is kind of what I want to get into this week and why I wanted to talk about white privilege and whiteness in general in this week, because we're about to go into Black History Month. You know, we're talking about this history of oppression and the history of the struggle for liberation that African Americans have been going through, have been living for the past, you know, more than 300 years in this continent, like in North America. You know, if you want to add, like, the, you know, and definitely add the Caribbean and, like, I would say, you know, South America as well. Like, you know, the very struggles for liberation that have been going on are ongoing, you know, with Black Lives Matter, with the Black Liberation Collective, which is now operational in Guelph, and what have you. So I believe I was starting from a place where I had not addressed certain things before I did that interview, or had planned to do that interview last week, and that's what made it so awkward for me, so very difficult for me. So what I want to do this week is I want to say a few words about whiteness and what it means to be a white man. Because if you want to stand in solidarity with Black, brown, and indigenous peoples as a white person, then you first have to know who and what you are. Because it's not something we can be in denial about. And I'll say what I've said on this show many times, white people must change, but to change, we must first understand what we are and what our place is in what Bobby Seale called this decadent racist society. Because if we don't understand our place in society, we can't relate to anything else. The white race, and you heard Tim Wise kind of talking a little bit about this, the white race is an artificial creation that was created for a specific purpose approximately 3 centuries ago to serve a specific class interest. By creating the white race through a series of laws passed at the beginning of the 18th century in the British colonies that would later become the United States, the colonial ruling class of merchants and plantation owners created an artificial oppressor people that over three centuries has become all too real. Deliberately privileged over others, white people, which ultimately is a haphazard combination of many European nationalities, which has been expanded arbitrarily at times to absorb Italian Americans and others originally considered to be non-white, white people have kept other people, other peoples, in thrall to the ruling capitalist class in North America. And in doing so, we kept ourselves in line as well. Effectively, we were created as enforcers for the slave system in the United States. We were created as obedient attack dogs, fed on scraps from our master's table. And until we learn to bite the hand that feeds us, until we learn to tug on our chain until it breaks, we will continue to be, as white people, little monsters, little servants of imperialism, because that is what we were created to be. A twisted and unnatural people, unfit to coexist with others because we do not understand the meaning of self-determination for ourselves as well as for others. Created as colonial enforcers, you know, through the law, through legal fictions, with a mindset firmly fixed on the denial of the crimes of empire, the empire in which we participated in and made possible, our only way out is to wake up to this. Is to stop denying our own history. To understanding what we've been a part of. And where whiteness actually comes from, what was created to do. Only when we come to grips with that history, and really address that history, can we stand in solidarity effectively alongside black, brown, indigenous peoples who are fighting for liberation today. So our task is a special task. We must do what many people believe to be impossible. Yet it must be done if the world, not just North American society, but the world, is ever to know peace. We must liberate an oppressor people. We must liberate ourselves from the capitalist class, which has used us as a weapon for so long against others. Remember, we were created to defend the slaveocracy in the United States. White people were created for that. You know, they were basically, you know, they took, as white, as Tim Wise talked about, they took penniless, landless peasants, gave them legal privileges, didn't really improve their economic condition very much at all, but gave them privilege over black people, over indigenous people, deluged them with a ton of propaganda, shaped their identity through that propaganda and through various legal structures over generations, and basically created a group of people who would be obedient servants to their class interests, you know, who would defend their profit motive, you know, who would defend the source of their income, you know, who would defend their prerogatives, their interests as a class. That was what we were created to do. That's what white people were created to do. The privilege that we have been given as the chosen servants of this class must be turned against it. In the end, we have the privilege to change ourselves and cast our masters from their pinnacles. We have the privilege to see the world as it really is. We have the privilege to mutiny. Really, our choice is very simple. We white people can either keep living a lie, keep deceiving ourselves about what black and brown people experience on a daily basis at our hands, and keep being loyal monsters for a monstrous system which degrades and exploits people. Or we can choose to become revolutionaries and resist. There is no middle ground. And this is why the white man must become revolutionary if he wants to save his soul. It is a choice that we all must make. And this is a this choice will decide whose side we are on in the class struggle. So really I have to ask white people, which side are you on? Because in the world today, we are the people most in need of redemption. And any actual objective look at history will tell you why that is. And any objective look on society as it is today, and who is the target of society today, who is being brutalized in society today, who is being beaten down, and who is doing the beating down, will tell you that none of this is ancient history. We are living right now with a history of oppression, and we are a part of that oppression. We have facilitated that oppression. We've obeyed orders in order to facilitate that oppression. We've done what the ruling class has expected of us. And because of that, millions of people, black and brown, indigenous, not just in North America, but around the world, have suffered and continue to suffer. And we have to understand our place in that system if we want to come to grips with what's really wrong in the world, and if we really want to change the situation. We have to refuse to play the role that we've been assigned. We have to join hands with black and brown indigenous people and resist. That's what I mean by mutiny, because we effectively are the guards of the system. We're the guards of the system. We enforce the system. And without us, the system becomes naked. It cannot enforce its will. It cannot keep people down. It cannot keep people in line. So as white people, we have to understand that we must rebel. We must no longer serve this system. We must no longer enforce its will. We must stand with those who are being oppressed by this system and have historically been oppressed. In doing so, we will change the world. And that can only be done if we refuse to obey orders. We have to mutiny. We have to bite the hand that feeds.
Can you get up off your knees? Welcome back to The Real News Network, and reality asserts itself. We're going to continue our discussion with Gerald Horn, but first I'm going to read a quote which I read at the beginning of the first segment. Men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. That was Karl Marx in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, written in 1852. Well, one of the things weighing on the brains of Americans is the concept of whiteness. At least half of voting America has voted against Barack Obama, and many of them, according to polling, voted against him because he was black. It's an underlying theme of American culture and politics, anything from gun control to how one looks at crime and mass incarceration rights. Racism runs deep and permeates the American psyche, but much of it comes from this nightmare weighing on people's brains from the past. And here's a quote from Gerald Horn's book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA. The construction of whiteness, or the forging of bonds between and among European settlers across class, gender, ethnic, and religious lines, was a concrete response to the real dangers faced by all of these migrants in the face of often violent rebellions from enslaved Africans and their indigenous comrades. Now joining us to talk about these slave rebellions and the role they played in the creation of America is Gerald Horn. Gerald's published over 30 books. He's a former executive director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. And as I said, his most recent book is The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the USA. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, there's lots of people talk about the American Revolution in terms of class, in terms of class struggle. But the class usually talked about is this American elite, the rising American owner class, and how they wanted freedom and they wanted to be free of British colonialism. Mm-hmm. There's not a heck of a lot of talk of what role working people played in this, but there's almost no talk about what the black slaves played. And in fact, instead of describing the revolution as this great explosion of democracy, you call it a counter-revolution. So we're going to work our way through your book. So start the story.
Well, the short response is that the revolt against British rule in mainland North America in 1776 was inspired in no small part by the fact that London was moving towards abolition of slavery, as evidenced by Somerset's case in June 1772, which, among other things, tended to ban slavery in England. And there was a perception on the mainland that it would be easy for that ruling to work its way across the Atlantic to the North American mainland settlements.
And then why were the British heading towards abolition?
Well, there hangs a tale. It depends on where you wanted me to enter the story. The short answer is that Britain was under enormous competitive pressure to move away from slavery. This was due in part to the fact that the Spanish in Florida, which they controlled intermittently from the 1500s up until 1821, had been arming Africans throughout that entire period and had been sending Africans from Spanish Florida and also from Spanish Cuba to pillage, plunder, and devastate British settlements in the Carolinas, in Georgia, in Virginia. This was putting pressure on Britain to likewise arm Africans, not least because there was a perception in London that some of those who were under London's jurisdiction, such as the Irish, for example, who had been colonized hundreds of years previously, were not necessarily reliable politically, nor the Scots, who may be seceding from the UK within weeks and who had only come under London's jurisdiction in 1707.
I mean, the Scots were far closer to the French than they were to the English.
Correct. And so there was a real perception that these nationals of the UK were not reliable politically, and then there was a competitive pressure from Spain, and also a certain kind of competitive pressure from the French in Quebec as well, because oftentimes in New York State, and also in the colony that was Massachusetts, you would have French trying to stir up the Africans in that part of North America against the British. However, this idea that the British were going to move towards abolition of slavery, not to mention arming Africans, encountered a wall of resistance in the North American settlements, because their idea was not to arm Africans. Their idea was to manacle and handcuff and march at gunpoint into the fields every African in sight. So this was part of the fissure that develops between the metropolis in London and the settlements that is detonated in July 1776. Now, of course, you could go back further to talk about how that story actually begins, which was with another revolution, the so-called Glorious Revolution in England in 1688, which, among other things, causes a reduction in power of the monarch, the king, as against the rising influence and power of the merchant class. This has a particular relevance to the African slave trade because the Royal African Company had been under the thumb of the monarch. But what happens with the Glorious Revolution is what I call the inauguration of free trade in Africans. The trade is deregulated, so to speak. Free trade is inaugurated, which causes the merchants to descend upon the African continent with the demented energy of crazed bees, manacling and handcuffing every African in sight, dragging them across the Atlantic, particularly to the Caribbean, Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, which up until the middle of the 18th century, London felt was more valuable than the mainland. However, the problem there was that oftentimes in these islands, the Africans were outnumbering the Europeans by a ratio of 20-1, which created fertile conditions for slave rebellions, which broke out with repetitive monotony. Antigua, 1709, 1736. The Maroons in Jamaica, who had basically escaped London's jurisdiction and were basically seeming to augur the collapse of the entire colonial project in Jamaica, which, because of its sugar, was seen as one of the most valuable pieces of real estate on planet Earth. So London was facing pressure to either have abolition of slavery in a helter-skelter manner, being chased out of the Caribbean by angry Africans, or more measured abolition. But abolition, whether helter-skelter or measured, was on the agenda, and that was not pleasing to mainland settlers.
Washington, mainland being United States mainland.
Exactly, North American mainland.
I mean the colonies at the time.
Exactly. Many of whom, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Madison, Patrick Henry, were all slave owners. Even a future U.S. president who was not necessarily involved in slavery, John Adams, was a lawyer for slave owners. John Hancock, whose name appears on the founding document, was one of the key slaveholders in Massachusetts, for example. You have to realize that slavery was not a sideshow. There is evidence to suggest that slave voyages and slavery itself was one of the most lucrative enterprises ever devised in the brain of human beings, sometimes profits of 1,700%. And as you know, living in North America, there are those today within a stone's throw of the studio who would sell their firstborn for a profit of 1,700%, let alone an African they did not know.
Now, let me ask you one sort of economic question here. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, I mean, Europe had gone through a whole stage of slave society and moves mm-hmm. to feudalism. Serfdom mm-hmm. Was a more consistent way with the technology of the time of exploiting labor than slavery was. I mean, slaves rebel, and sometimes they break their tools and plows, and serfs are a little more controllable in theory. Why was slavery so productive, in a sense, in North America, and especially in the South?
Well, U.S. historians today generally argue that despite these, quote, problems you've just articulated, slavery remained profitable up to the time it was abolished in the United States in 1865. And an entire superstructure had developed to justify slavery. What I mean is the ideology that the Africans were inferior, that if Africans were enslaved, they would butcher each other. And this,
you got to dehumanize those you enslave.
Of course. But this also provides momentum and an impetus to continue slavery as well, because many people felt that they were rescuing these Africans from a benighted African continent by bringing them across the Atlantic. They were being, quote, Christianized, unquote. And so therefore, it was seen as something of a benevolent enterprise by all too many.
So the reason all this matters is because you're arguing much of this structural racism and this strength of the far right, particularly in white south of the United States, mm-hmm. this is part of this, it's an outgrowth of this history. This culture has been created, as we, in the quote, it weighs on people's minds. They're born into this and kind of nurtured and educated in this culture of white supremacy and whiteness as a concept. So this ain't just about some history for the sake of, isn't this interesting? This is about what we're facing today has its roots here, and if we want to get at it, you need to know the roots. So start us off in where the book starts.
Well, you may recall that just a few moments ago in talking about growing up in St. Louis, I made a reference to something I called the Black Scare. And I cited examples of this fear about black people in North America. They'll carjack you, they'll eat your babies, and all the rest. And this becomes problematic when the time comes to organize people on a class basis, when you have this racial divide and this racial fear and racial hysteria. It oftentimes, such as in Louisiana in 1991, causes people to vote for the far right, that is to say, white Americans. As I talk about in the book...
Just to remind people that this is when they vote for David Duke.
A Nazi and a Klansman.
He's a Nazi, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite remarkable. It requires deep and intense study. If you look at how and why loyal subjects of the British Crown revolted in North America against constituted authority, that's what a revolution is. You have to understand that in a place like North Carolina, for example, one of the major reasons they revolted was fear of the Black Scare, which I just talked about with regard to the 20th century and the 21st century. That is to say, there was a fear that Britain was going to arm Africans to squash and discipline settler discontent, for example, over taxes. For example, this is where the traditional story enters the picture.
And Africans had a reason to do this because the English are moving towards abolition, and so they're offered the chance of freedom if they make this alliance.
They thought that they would get a better deal. You have to realize that history oftentimes does not present pristine and simple choices between good guys and bad guys. Oftentimes it's choosing between who has a dirty shirt and who has a very dirty shirt. And with regard to 1776, many of the Africans decided that Britain just had a dirty shirt and the settlers had a very dirty shirt. It's not unlike the so-called Anglo-Boer War, 1899 to 1902 in South Africa, where settlers, so-called Boer settlers, descendants of Dutch migrants, revolted against British rule. And you'll find that virtually to a man and woman, the African majority in South Africa sided with the Union Jack. They sided with the British. It's not because they thought the British were heroes or good guys. It's just that they felt that they had the cleanest dirty shirt, so to speak, compared to the Boer settlers. And they were probably right. And I dare say that with regard to 1776, it should not come as a surprise that almost by an order of magnitude, the Africans sided with the Crown against the settlers, which also helps to explain the continuing animus against people of African descent, not least descendants of mainland enslaved Africans, because of the fact that we, and I use the term we, rebelled against this supposedly heroic project establishing the United States of America. It also sheds light on the fact of why I say in the book that racism, the term I use and have probably used in this conversation, is a necessary but insufficient explanation of what has befallen people of African descent in North America. Because if racism were sufficient, then it wouldn't do little to explain why it was that in the 1950s and 1960s, when African diplomats started coming to the United States and coming to this area and traveling up the highway from Washington to New York and stopping at segregated enterprises in Maryland, that the State Department wanted to give these African diplomats buttons to wear on their lapels so that they could be distinguished from we U.S. Negroes. Now, if these people were racist, they treat the African diplomats terribly, too. They're dark skinned, darker than I am. But they're making distinctions between and amongst them. I think partly the condition of black people can be explained as a political condition. As much as it can be explained as a condition of racism.
The book, the title of the first chapter is How Caribbean Slavery Came to the Mainland. I think a lot of what's unique about your work is this unraveling or explanation of the close association to what happened to the Caribbean and the United States and the slave trade back and forth.
Well, absolutely. You have to realize that these colonies were not a unitary project. They were not one unit, that is to say, mainland of North America, Jamaica, or Antigua, Barbados. But there was a certain commonality and unity between and amongst them. And surely, when you had slave revolts, as you had frequently in the Caribbean because of the ratios, sometimes the Europeans being outnumbered 20 to 1, the settlers in these Caribbean islands made a great trek from Jamaica, Antigua, Barbados in particular, to the North American mainland, oftentimes bringing their Africans in tow, oftentimes helping to bolster the European settler enterprise in the Carolinas and in Virginia, and helping to give a shot of adrenaline to the slave system in North America. That's part of the explanation of how there's this unity of interest between the Caribbean and the North American mainland.
And you mentioned in the earlier segment, but talk a bit more just how important the slave rebellions were in the shaping of the politics of the time.
Well, first of all, it helps to infuse the Black Scare. I mean, when I was writing this book, some of my editors were suggesting to me that I was going overboard in talking about African resistance, shipboard insurrections, mass poisoning plots. Poison, for example, was a particular tool of enslaved women in under slavery.
They're preparing the food for the slave master.
Exactly. Arson is a continuing problem. Having your throat slit in the middle of the night is a continuing problem. And so obviously this is helping to infuse the Black Scare. People become afraid of dark-skinned people. Some might say for good reason, but it's the system under which all of these people are forced to labor that's creating this violence. And one can make an argument that this systemic violence is still with us to a degree, helping to shed light on the amazing number of gun crimes in the United States, the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which has been interpreted, as you know, to give citizens the right to bring there are guns openly into a Starbucks in Texas, for example. I think you can't understand what seem to be bizarre episodes unless you understand the roots of these bizarre episodes.
So this period of the tremendous growth and expansion of the slave economy and the massive profits achieved, it's the basis of... Is it how much, I guess, is the question, is it the basis of what then becomes the industrialization of America and the banking system and all the what becomes the more modern infrastructure?
This is not a new idea, even though I think it's something I try to dig into on perhaps a deeper, more profound level than has been dug into previously. That is to say that Eric Williams, a founding father of Trinidad and Tobago, in his books Capitalism and Slavery that came out 70 years ago, wrote about this. Walter Rodney, the late great Guyanese historian, wrote about this in his book How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. You cited Karl Marx at the top of this interview. Of course, Karl Marx wrote about this in Capital, about how the system of capitalism enters upon the world stage with the blood of Africans gushing from every pore. In terms of what Marx talks about in terms of primitive accumulation, the fuel that leads to the takeoff of the system largely comes from the African slave trade. Slavery was not a sideshow. It was not a sectional issue. What I mean by a sectional issue is that it wasn't just a product of the South, Virginia going southward, because it was financed from the North, New York in particular, but also Rhode Island, also Boston. Not only that, but it was not only financed from these areas, oftentimes the ships left from these areas, and so therefore when you had shipboard insurrections, there were nationals from Rhode Island who were being massacred, which helped to unite those Rhode Islanders on the basis of antipathy towards African with Virginians and Georgians and Carolinians. So slavery provides the fuel for the development of this modern society that some are able to enjoy, which is one of the reasons why when I used to have conversations with certain friends from abroad about how they wanted to build a society like the United States, well, I would say, well, you know, find millions of people to work for free for a few centuries, and you can have a modern society too. And I think that this is oftentimes lost sight of, particularly when it comes to talking about reparations for slavery, the free labor that Africans provided to this country. Many people would suggest, well, you know, my relatives only came here 30 years ago, so what do I have to do with slavery? But you're enjoying a society which was built upon the backs, not only of enslaved Africans, but I should also say, built upon the back of land that was taken from the indigenous population. And one of the points I try to stress in this particular book is not only the fact that slavery was an impetus for 1776, but also a proclamation that London had made in circa 1763 to keep the settlers from moving steadily west, seizing the land of the indigenous, because that led to clashes, which led to London having to send redcoats, and London was trying to contain India at that particular moment in history. It was jousting with the Spanish and Cartagena.
There was a big debate going on in amongst the English elite at the time whether this whole colonial project isn't just a boat anchor. This whole thing's just costing too much.
You are correct. And so when these settlers are then pushing further west, coming into conflict with Native Americans and First Nations peoples, indigenous people, it's draining the exchequer in London. And that's leading to a fissure. That's leading to a split of opinion between mainland North American opinion and settled opinion in London, which erupts in a revolt against British rule, leading to the formation of the United States of America.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion with Gerald Horn on Reality Asserts Itself, so please join us for the next segment. And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
Come on, you poor workers, good news to you, I'll tell how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? We're starting our good battle. We know we're sure to win because we've got the gun thugs all looking very thin. Which side are you on?
Come all you good workers, good news to you, I'll tell how the good old union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?